Accession number 10434, rule 2.
Mr. Jameson, real toe.
And by the time I went to France, we had, of course, the respirators that were in a satchel at your side, and which were much less uncomfortable to wear. During that first day, in a ridge some distance ahead, Germans appeared like a crowd coming out of a football match, and we were ordered to have rapid fire at maximum range. And that huge crowd just melted away. We never saw them again.
How far from you were they?
They were probably, I think, about 800 yards away. But everybody was firing in the air into this huge mass of people. What they were supposed to be doing, I don't know.
How much cover did the Germans have?
They were just on a ridge. They had no cover at all. Whether they came forward in mass formation from the point of view of morale, I just don't know.
So
it was very strange.
What do you think happened to them? Do you think they were...
They must have had big casualties and just run away. And after that happened, we advanced to where they had come from. And
how soon after?
Quite soon afterwards. And a host of German aeroplanes appeared. And we went into a sunken road and then out of it again. And some of them were dropping bombs and some of them were machine gunning us. And we got out of this road, and I remember lying down in a large bomb crater and counting about 30 German planes all round, but there were none of ours there. And
were there many casualties from the planes?
No. And from there, we retired into a redoubt that had been built. And that night, we was fairly quiet. And we retired again the next day to what was known as the Green Line at Nurlu, Nurlu.
What was the Green Line exactly?
The Green Line was a recently constructed defence trench that was nothing like finished. It was far too wide. It had no firing steps. And while we were there, the order came along, this position must be held at all costs to the last man.
What date have we reached now?
The 22nd of March. And I felt terrible. I just thought, I'm only 19. I've only been here 5 weeks. And apparently I'm going to be killed. And how am I going to be killed? Fortunately, the Germans got round on both flanks of this system, and we had to retire from it. And we had only gone a short distance when a South African officer who was attached temporarily to us stopped us and said, "We go back and occupy that ridge to cover the retirement of the South Africans." Well, the South Africans had in fact already gone through. He didn't know this. And as we ran forward a short distance to this ridge, a German machine gun opened up on our right, and the man next to me, who was only 2 or 3 yards away, fell. And I stopped to see if I could do anything, which in retrospect seems ridiculous. Why I wasn't shot by the machine gun, I don't know. But I just stopped momentarily, and a corporal said, "Carry on to this little ridge," which I did. And he dropped beside me a few minutes later and said, "He's gone west." And this man, who was a man of about 40, one of the higher ages to be called up, was the only man I knew who wore a bulletproof waistcoat. But it only covered him back and front, and he must have been shot through the side.
When you were advancing, did you advance at the run or the walk?
Oh, yes. No, we just ran forward, a matter of 50 yards or so, and lay down. And we fired at one or two Germans who appeared, and then we retired ourselves and came down to a river, which I think would be the Somme, to a bridge. And the bridge had been blown up before we arrived by our own people. And so we had to clamber down. It had rails on either side, and we had to clamber down the bridge into the water and then clamber up the other side. And the Germans, because of the troops who were gathering there, the Germans were shelling it heavily, up the slope to the old trenches of 1916. And this was when this boy fell and started kicking about and shouting, and I managed to get him up onto his feet, and then I pulled him into the old trench, and he was suffering from shell shock.
Was he from your unit?
Yes. And I then was told to take him to a first aid post, and which was pointed out to me. But the time I got there, it had retired, and I had to follow up. And I finally, on the road between Roncourt and Combles, I stopped and asked a doctor who was attending to wounded to give me a note that I had reported to him, because I was carrying this boy's rifle as well as my own and supporting him, and I was frightened that I might be thought to be a deserter. And he gave me a note and sent me on to a CRS, and there, when I handed over my patient, I got a note from the doctor who said I was to stay overnight. And the next day, I joined the battalion again the next morning, which was very much reduced in numbers, and we marched to the village of Ettenham. Ettenham, I think it is. And were put into buildings there. This was a village, of course, that had never been affected by the war. And we just fell asleep there. I mean, we hadn't had much in the way of food for several days, and we were exhausted. And in the middle of the night, a sergeant came in and said the Germans were in the village, and they weren't. And I think he had sampled the rum jar before he arrived. And in any case, we had to leave the village, and we marched from there to near Arlbear with fires everywhere, with dumps being blown up. And we had marched quite a distance, but whenever we fell out, so many people had to be wakened up again because they were so exhausted. And we finally lined up in the early hours of the morning in a road out from Arlbear. And at one stage from there, we were told, some of us were told to go down to a canteen and collect as much food as we could. And I was the first person at the canteen, and I went in and picked up a tin of biscuits, and a voice said, "Hands up." And I turned round, and it was a brigade major pointing a revolver at me. And at that stage, a sergeant arrived and some other people, and the position was explained, and we took what we could back to this roadway. And then again, apparently the Germans were coming round on the flanks, and we had retired to the railway line outside Arlbear.
What kind of mood was that brigade major in?
Well, he had been put in charge of this canteen, whose staff had deserted it. And I think he probably looked on himself as being, at that stage, a wee bit more important. But he had been, in fact, in charge of A Company of the 11th Royal Scots before he was sent to brigade. And after the war, at one stage, he became Lord Provost of Edinburgh, Sir Will Y. Darling. We had a terrible time on that embankment at Arlbear. We had open flanks. We had suffered severe casualties on the Somme, further back, and at Nourloo, for instance. And we were in no state to hold this railway line. And for a day and a half, we were heavily shelled and mortared and so on. And I remember at one point, I was there was a little railway siding going off the main line, and I was taken out and told to lie down on the embankment of the siding and listen for Germans so that I could give advance notice to the troops holding the main line if I heard anything. And while I was lying there, something landed on the ground just beside my face, and then I felt that it landed on my shoulder and I put my hand up and there was a flattened bullet. And I don't know where it came from, whether it was from our own side and somebody saw me in a shadowy way and thought I was a German, but it just missed me by an inch or two anyway. And I was very glad when I was brought in from there. And then I was, as daylight came, a corporal with a Lewis gun was sent to lie between the two sets of rails facing in towards Albert railway station. And I was lying beside him with two others, and nothing much was happening. And this corporal sent two of the others over to the edge of an embankment where it was a bit safer, and I was lying there with him, and once or twice a German ran across the rails and we fired at him, but that was that. And then he told me to move over, a matter of about, 15 yards perhaps, to this edge of the embankment where the others were. And while I was lying there, a sniper was causing casualties amongst our people along the railway line. And I could hear the report, and I knew that he was causing trouble, and I knew it was coming roughly from a little embankment, and I was watching there, and suddenly I saw a puff of smoke, and I counted the telegraph poles, and I was able to call over to the Lewis gunner, "He's between the 6th and 7th telegraph pole in a hedge." And shortly afterwards, the Lewis gun sent off a few rounds, and that was the end of the sniping. And then at one point I saw a mortar bomb coming, and could see it quite clearly, and I knew that it was going to land very near me or the Lewis gunner, and it landed between us with tremendous explosion and stones from the railway line flying in all directions and smoke. And when it cleared away, I was astonished to see him still lying there with his Lewis gun, and I was unharmed. And the rails had the set of rails was so shattered that they were pointing four fingers to the sky, and the crater in underneath, and never thought anything about it. I mean, it never occurred to me, what would I have been like if it had hit me, you know? Even by that time, although I'd only been barely a week under fire, I was just used to things. And we were, I knew at one stage, because I had seen them, that the Australians tried to relieve us, but they were brought under such heavy artillery fire on coming down a slope towards the railway that they gave up. But during the night, a man suddenly dropped beside me and said, "Get the hell out of it, Jock." And I did. And the Australians had a terrible time the next day, as we had had for a day. And but they were in numbers that we had never been in. And that was the extent of the German advance. Never got any further.
What date was this?
I think the 24th, 25th of March. And we were then relieved and sent up to Ypres, where the Australians had come from.
What was your morale like when you were relieved, you and your comrades?
Oh, tremendous. I mean, you know, we thought that in some way or other, either prisoner of war or killed or wounded, that that would be pretty much the end. But it just wasn't. We went up to Ypres instead.
Can you say what happened next as you went up to Ypres?
Well, I know according to a book that I've since read by the Brigadier, I remember the train was bombed on the way to Ypres, which of course was quite a considerable distance. And when we got up there, we were immediately put into the line near Hill 60, a place called Spoil Bank, at the side of the Ypres-Comines Canal.
How did conditions at Ypres compare with the Somme?
Well, we went into the line, and of course we went up in darkness, and it was that area, of course, was just nothing but a mass of shell holes, all flooded, and duck boards here and there, and a track up beside them. And of course the duck boards got smashed and people fell into the shell holes and so on. And when we were there, we were in a very deep dugout. The whole of headquarters were in this dugout, all the signalers. Now I had only, when we went up to Ypres, I've missed out something here. When we went up there, we immediately got reinforcements, and I was then transferred to the signalling corps, and went up the line, and in daylight, Sergeant came out of this huge dugout, which had pumps going all the time to keep it from flooding. The smell in it was terrible, and it had several floors. It held a great number of people. You went down steps into it, and he told me that I was to use a Lucas signalling lamp to brigade, and I lay in a little mound at the side of the canal, and he pointed out a saddle in the ground further down on the opposite side, and he said, "That's about where brigade are." And he told me what the brigade code number was, and I kept signalling to this brigade headquarters, and nothing was happening. And then shells started arriving, some of them pretty close to me, and I was very glad when the sergeant suddenly appeared at the dugout and shouted to me to come in. And I went in, and as I did, I turned round, and a shell arrived, and the mound I'd been lying on was no longer there. And
did you arrive at Ypres in April or
yes,
at the end of March?
The end of March. The end of March. Yes. I was then ordered to go to brigade headquarters as a runner, that is, running with messages between brigade and the battalions in the line. And I found that the brigade headquarters were on the same side of the canal as we were on. And I had probably been signalling to the German lines. And the first night with brigade in their dugout, it came to the issue of rum. And the sergeant who was pouring it out, I suddenly said, "Stop," because he was pouring out so much. And of course, it was always considered that the rum jar was well examined on the way up to the front line, and that the people in the front line got a lot less than the people further behind. And the brigade major, this Captain Darling, who was supervising the issue of the rum, he looked at me when I said stop. He looked at me in astonishment and said, "A member of Blood Company says stop. Carry on, Sergeant." Now, the brigade major had been in command of A Company of the 11th Royal Scots, in which I was, and our shoulder flash was red and on parade, although as a signaller I was attached to headquarters and not with the company. I was a member of A Company, you see, and on parade he didn't address it as A Company, he addressed it as Blood Company.
Do you remember which platoon you were in?
No. And so I was with brigade when the German offensive at Ypres started in April. And we were in I would call it a peak rather than a mountain, called Scherpenberg, in a camp there. And